Also, I think they're going to find that the cold temperatures have started to shut down some of these fields. We're seeing, I hear it from farmers after farmers, and I've seen it myself, where fields are starting to get this light tinge straight across the top of the fields, whereby the beans are starting to kind of like, they're just thinking about it's about time for them to come home. And it's been awfully cool. We need some heat in here. Beans can surprise you, but we need some heat in here to kind of pop, fill out the rest of these pods. And next week we'll start hearing this crop touring. We'll hear just how many pods they think that's out there. This is Sue Martin with Ag Investments. Have a good day.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by Euromart International Food Store on Springfield and Locust in Champaign, offering 8,000 food items from Europe, South America, the Middle East, and the Orient. The Euromart hosts a cheese and olive tasting every Saturday.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. Today, the afternoon magazine features an interview from the AM 580 archives. Since it's a recorded interview, we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Can our doctors make us better than well? Can they make us over? Now in its second season, the ABC reality show Extreme Makeover has received more than 10,000 written applications for what the show's promoters call a once-in-a-lifetime chance for a truly Cinderella experience. The magic, they say, is conjured through the skills of an extreme team, including plastic surgeons, eye surgeons, dentists, personal trainers, and others. Is the extreme team the way to happily ever after? Today on the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk with historians Sheila and David Rothman, authors of The Pursuit of Perfection, The Promise and Perils of Medical Enhancement. They say in the coming decades, enhancements are likely to affect brain functioning, physical capacity, behavioral traits, and lifespan. And they say, quoting here, the drive to enhancement is so deeply entrenched in our science and culture that neither religious nor social objections will be able to withstand, divert, or regulate it. Let me tell you a bit more about our guests, Sheila and David Rothman. David Rothman is Bernard Schoenberg, Professor of Social Medicine and History at Columbia University. His books have explored the history of prisons and mental hospitals and the impact of bioethics and law on medicine. Sheila Rothman is Professor of Public Health at Columbia University. Her books include Living in the Shadow of Death and Women's Proper Place. Her articles, often co-written with her husband David, address human rights and medicine. Their book, The Pursuit of Perfection, is published by Pantheon Books. Sheila and David Rothman, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
When you use the term, let's talk about some things that are really basic here. When you use the term medical enhancement, what do you mean? How does medical enhancement differ from treating disease?
Well, I think the drive to enhancement is really in very fundamental ways different than cure, but ends up in a very neat way being inseparable from it the more you look into it. We all know we go to a physician, we've got a pain, we've got a disease, and we look for a cure. But what we're trying to parse out and analyze is when we go to a physician, not because we've got a disease, but because we want to optimize our well-being. We want to be better than well. We don't want to return to the normal on the chart. We want to be at the super normal. And what's surprising is that we have both the science, the medicine, the commercial drive, and the readiness of people to try to move that needle over, to try to go past normal to better than normal. And that's what we've been trying to analyze.
Yeah. And what's wrong with trying to be better than normal?
Oh, I don't think there's anything, so to speak, wrong with it. What's intriguing, of course, is what risks are people prepared to pay in order to try to move that needle over. When you're sick and, you know, you've got disease and, you know, there's a medication which is likely to work but carries some side effects, you'll make a calculus of how bad my disease, what are the risks of this intervention, how do the risks of the intervention compare with the risks of the disease. And I think most people make a relatively sophisticated and balanced judgment about the risks of the intervention versus the benefits of the intervention when you've got disease. But the question is, when you're, quote, normal, when you're not in a disease state, when you're going along perfectly fine, how do you begin to make a risk-benefit kind of calculation? What risks will you run in order to try to improve your memory? What risks will you run to see if you can't build up your endurance? What risks are you prepared to take in order to look better? Those are the sorts of issues that are central to us.
Yeah. In the book, you talk about how cures have become enhancements. What's the process? How does a cure become enhancement?
It's a very interesting process, and it really relates to the first question that you were asking. These things seem to kind of blur together, that you can get a drug that's used for a cure, and it can be then used for another process to enhance your memory or something like that. You could get a drug that wants to deal with narcolepsy or something like that, and then you can get it to move over towards enhancement. And estrogen kind of is exactly that kind of drug that we're talking about, where you first use it to deal with symptoms post-menopause, and then you begin to see what it can do to enhance performance and behavior.
Yeah. You write a good deal about the history of estrogen as a therapy for women, a therapy that was sold to women as a way to avoid suffering, quote, living decay.
Right.
There would be no decay in bone, in mental activity, in femininity.
Yes, very much so. But what was intriguing to us was that even before the 1960s, almost to the turn of the century, this whole notion of what the femininity of estrogen represented and what it could do for women was very much in the minds of scientists, clinicians, drug companies, and women themselves. So that it's not even just a history of 40 years or 50 years. It's a history of 100 years where you've been kind of playing with this substance to see how you can improve women's functioning, memory, and so on. Not only as a cure, but really as an enhancement as we're talking about it.
Yeah. Now, when did women begin going to their doctors and asking for estrogen therapy?
Well, they really start going around 1950, in the early 1950s. But even before then, there were some kinds of very primitive, what we would think of as very primitive remedies that physicians would give to women post-menopause to help them improve, to make them feel better, to make them happier. And it's this kind of notion of trying to make women happier that gets very much involved with this whole estrogen story.
Yeah.
But as women start going to doctors, of course, as we write at some length, it's not some kind of accident. The drug companies are very busily advertising and promoting the use of estrogen replacement therapy, eventually hormone replacement therapy. It's no accident that, you know, it's not this kind of sudden, you know, sort of discovery. These are promotions. And they not only promote it, the drug companies not only promote it to physicians, but as in the case of one Dr. Wilson, they are quite clever at, so to speak, buying physicians to become publicists for the drug. Sheila, say a little bit about, you know, Wilson.
Yeah, I mean, well, people have talked a lot about Robert Wilson, but, I mean, he was clearly chosen by the drug company for the way he looked, for the way he could communicate, for the way he was willing to go public and talk about all that estrogen could do. And women began to go into their doctors and say, I want that youth pill. I want to feel better. And I think we also have to talk about the role of culture. I mean, you mentioned this whole thing with extreme makeovers.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the culture for a long time has kind of encouraged this kind of pursuit of perfection. I mean, we go back into the 1920s, into the first films, into the way that, you know, the images on the screen encouraged women and men as well to begin to think about how they wanted to look, how they could look, could they be like that, and what could help them do it. And they often found that physicians and drug pharmaceutical companies were very willing to help them take on that task. So, I mean, you can't really have one without the other, and they're very intricately bound. I mean, the whole way that science thinks about nature and the natural and what it can do to improve on nature, and the way physicians begin to think about this, and the way the popular culture encourages people to think about this.
Yeah. Well, what are your thoughts about extreme makeover, speaking of popular culture?
I really haven't seen it, but I've seen some of it going on, and I think it's very, very seductive to people. And I think that the whole thing that I can be somebody different, I can be somebody I really want to be, and that this is possible, is, you know, it is seductive. And I think what we are trying to do when we're talking about this is say, hold on, wait a minute, just think, it may not work out exactly as you want, and you've really got to think about why you're making this decision, and what could be not only the benefits, but what we know about the risks that are involved in each of these different therapies that you're going into.
Yeah.
And our book is kind of a way of saying, let's think about risks. Let's not presume that enhancement is just a free lunch.
Yeah. The show has a Cinderella element. I mean, the promoters use that word, Cinderella, and they use the word magic, and they use the word conjure. And the participants are not paying the bills. This raises this question. Do you see further inequities in healthcare on the horizon in the way of medical enhancements?
Well, it's an excellent question, and it's one of the kind of basic points that critics make of enhancement, that it won't be fair. That, you know, if we do develop some interventions that would, say, improve memory or reduce the need for sleep or build up physical capacity, that will give a biological edge to people who already have an economic edge. And that, you know, to those shall be given yet more. Our own sense is that, well, it's a fair kind of statement, and it's, you know, in a country which leaves, you know, over 40 million people uninsured, there's a point there. But we wouldn't rest the case against enhancement on the grounds of potential inequity. I mean, from our perspective, you know, almost any intervention in medicine could be held up to that light and, you know, get a new very expensive drug to, you know, deal with sepsis in an intensive care unit. And you can say again, well, look, it's the rich that are going to benefit. Rather than fuss about the inequity, I mean, we would rather say, look, if there's something that really good that comes on the market, well, for goodness sake, we've got to be obliged to make sure everybody gets it. But I wouldn't rest the case against enhancement on the prospect of future inequity. Anything can be, you know, I mean, anything can be, you know, laid at that door. I think there are greater problems. There are the fantasies, there are the risks, there's the real difficulty of getting solid information about what it is that you're taking and where the problems may rest. I think the thing we found that kind of disturbed us most is this kind of explosion-implosion process. Something comes out, oh, it looks fabulous. Growth hormone for older people, testosterone for older men. Sheila's talked about estrogen for postmenopause women. There's a big flash of attention. Often front page news, a new way to conquer aging. God, the papers have been filled with that for months. You know, new ways to improve your memory. And then the research goes on, and it not only suggests that you're not going to get that goal that you're after, but that, in fact, along with that new seemingly, you know, powerful enhancement come a series of really major risks, so that the use of growth hormone by elderly men is not only ineffective in building body mass or in, you know, really increasing, you know, functional capacity, but ultimately may do damage. There really is no free lunch. And, you know, no free lunch, but, you know, the cultural pressures like that program you're talking about, the pressures by, you know, advertisers and drug companies to promote it, the readiness of too many doctors to go along with it. Those are, you know, you've got to be alert to that process in order to really be a sophisticated and, you know, self-protecting consumer.
Okay, well, practically then, how do we go about separating the junk from good medicine?
The trouble is, let me start with the good news. We probably live in an age of information about medicine which is unparalleled. I mean, there really is data out there. It comes in a variety of forms. I think lots of people are learning to navigate the web, are really learning to check out the story, going beyond just simply, you know, taking the news account as at face value, and starting to become, you know, not quite doctors, but very, very sophisticated consumers. We do this in disease now all the time. I mean, at least, you know, those who have, you know, with some, well, you know, the educational standards can vary on this, but it's not beyond the ability of, you know, high school graduates, college graduates to understand a lot of this stuff, and in disease, they're doing it. People are beginning to understand their options. What worries us is that when you come into enhancement, they drop that kind of sophisticated consumerism and fall prey to the promise. I think that's the difficulty. The liposuction case that Sheila talks about is a great case in point.
Yeah, tell us about the history of liposuction.
Well, the history of liposuction is kind of just a wonderful serendipitous history. I mean, where you kind of have physicians or surgeons really trying to figure out a way to deal with excess fat, and a Paris physician finally discovers it through a very serendipitous process. And women, he's not accepted by the French medical societies or surgical societies at all. They're very suspicious of him, but women immediately understand that this is great, and they begin to line up outside his door. And then American physicians quickly catch on to it and bring it back to the United States. And liposuction becomes much more popular here than it is in Europe, and it really takes hold here very much. And it's really used very much, you know, to deal with weight loss and so on and so forth, although that was not the original intention. But what becomes so problematic about liposuction, this is what David was raising, is that as you begin to take out more and more and more fat, there become problems with it, and you're doing it in public, in offices, and not in hospitals. And so some women do get into trouble, and then there are some deaths from an enhancement procedure. And yet what troubled us a great deal was not merely that the health departments didn't deal with it, but that consumers weren't demanding to have some kind of oversight mechanism, some monitoring mechanisms, so that one could see that if one was going to have this procedure, that it was going to be done as safely as possible and with guidelines that would protect consumers. So it was the absence of a call for any type of protection, any type of oversight, any type of monitoring that was so troublesome about this procedure, where what one felt that if this had been a therapeutic procedure, that somebody would have moved in.
Yeah, well, this was a procedure, and it continues to be a procedure, that a lot of people want. And doctors were eager to help their patients, and it's quite a profitable operation. What's the status today? I know that a number of, I think I saw a report on this on television some years back now, that there wasn't much training required, if any training required, for some of these cosmetic, let's call them, enhancements that could be very, very serious.
Well, you know, you always have this problem in medicine that, you know, once you become a doctor, so to speak, you can do anything. Obviously, there are a series of board certifications, but the board certifications are kind of a seal of competence, but do not prevent those without those board certifications from doing the procedure. I think what Sheila found most, you'll correct me, is that it wasn't so much that incompetent people were doing it, but rather that you had this competition between the surgeons and the dermatologists that set off a sort of warfare as to who could suction out more, you know, at greater speed and more efficiently. And as surgeons begin it, then the dermatologists come in and they say, well, wait a minute, we can do that. And then the surgeons say, hey, wait a minute, we're getting competition, we can do more. And you end up in this cycle in which the driving currency is the amount of fat to be suctioned. So it's not that they weren't trained so much. It's that they keep upping the ante. Let's do more. And if we do more, then our competitors, you know, won't be able to, you know, match us. And we'll get more patients / clients.
And it also goes back to the issue that you were raising before, that because these are enhancements, they're not paid for by insurance companies. So doctors try to do them in a setting that will be affordable for patients, and in this case it's often in outpatient settings where the patient then goes home at night, and they're often not monitored, and so they can get into trouble that way. So I mean, it's this whole issue of doing more, and oftentimes surgeons will talk about the fact that a woman agrees to have three areas of the body liposuction, then come in and wants more. And the surgeon agrees to do it because the woman would get upset, and it's that kind of relationship because she's a paying customer, and then problems start. So it's this kind of feeding on, you know, more and more for enhancement, more and more fat to be sucked out, more and more and more, that in part causes many of the risks that go on.
Yeah. Going back, I'm thinking once again of Robert Wilson and his advice to women on how to find a physician. You know, find someone who's sympathetic.
To do this, yes. And there have been surgeons who tell me that they've told women no, that when they come back again and again for liposuction, they've even recommended that they go to see a psychiatrist. But, you know, the women don't go. They'll go to find somebody else who will do it. So, it's this dilemma for everyone as to, you know, what to do and how to do it, and particularly since this isn't a therapeutic procedure, but, you know, a strict cash, and often cash 2 weeks in advance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's money in medicine in a different kind of way than we're used to thinking of it.
Well, there are also, in terms of our body image and overweight, there are also over-the-counter supplements or fat burners and all that kind of thing. There's also surgery to staple the stomach.
By the way, there's a good case of a process that at the beginning is said, well, this is terrific. We finally have a way of, you know, dealing with obesity. The more we learn about the long-term, not all that long-term consequences of that surgical procedure, the more disastrous it appears to be. So again, you know, early enthusiasms really bring a lot of folks in, but Act Two gives a very different picture, and the surgical stapling is a good case in point.
Yeah. Anyway, whether it's taking a pill or an elective surgery, do you think our reliance on these things may be affecting our thinking about diet, nutrition, and exercise, either giving us a distorted view of our bodies or contributing to that, or, you know, or offering us a quick fix?
Well, I think the quick fix is the issue. I mean, why watch your diet if, in fact, you know, there's going to be some intervention that will allow it to, melt away? Why bother with exercise? I mean, the quick fix in a, you know, culture that's busy, people moving, you know, wanting to get the most at the least expenditure of energy and effort. It's very, very tempting. And of course, those of us who, you know, try to withstand this and watch, you know, I mean, I think I doubt that there's Everyone in your audience, I think, has watched someone wolf down, you know, hamburgers and French fries, and then when they've raised their eyebrows, will be told, well, you know, what's my problem about this? I'm on a, you know, cholesterol-lowering drug. And you kind of scratch your head and you say, gee, you know, is that really the way to go? Now, you don't want to get moralistic. I mean, you know, people are entitled to choose their lifestyles. But you just wish that they were a little bit more alert to the fact that the quick fix often turns out to be not merely ineffective, but dangerous.
Hmm. Our guests this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine, Sheila Rothman and David Rothman. They are the authors of The Pursuit of Perfection, The Promise and Perils of Medical Enhancement. Well, let's talk about brain functioning. If we saw advances in the treatment or prevention of Alzheimer's disease, for example, shouldn't that be lauded? Would you talk with us about what perils might be out there for improved memory, improved brain functioning?
Well, at the moment, the technology hasn't quite caught up. Everyone, you know, looks, you know, eagerly for science to be able to enhance memory. The young would want it. People, as they get older, want it even more. A great pursuit. And I think every one of us can empathize with the, you know, if only there were some way to make sure that as I grow older, my memory won't slip. Because of that kind of, you know, enthusiasm for the intervention, lots and lots of interventions are, you know, thought about, and a few, you know, have been tried. For a long time, the expectation was that estrogen itself might prove to be memory enhancing. And as, you know, it was to do, as Sheila said, it would be heart protective, it would be bone protective, and ultimately there were thoughts that it would also enhance memory. Well, it turns out it doesn't work that way. The data, not always easy to go through, but the data is fairly conclusive at this point that estrogen will not do anything for your memory. In fact, I could make the rather broad statement, listeners are going to be sorry to hear it, I'm sorry to have to say it, we do not have at the moment any intervention that will enhance memory. I will also have to follow that with an equally, you know, valid but ultimately not cheerful kind of statement. We do not have any intervention now that will serve as an anti-aging intervention. The press is filled with tales, mm-hmm. And raises expectation. You know, anti-aging is coming down at us. We don't have to expect to live to 80. When we really get to understand the aging process, we can anticipate, you know, lives of 140 to 160 years, and we'll each have to remember, but, you know, given the interventions, we'll be able to, the names of our great-great-great-great-grandchildren. Lots of press, lots of attention. Anti-aging, I think, is one of those things that is now, I mean, really, you know, dominating a whole bunch of medical scientific stories. There are anti-aging clinics, and I'm not sure if you've got one where you are, but we have some in New York. They're in Arizona. You can find them in Florida and California. That, you know, sir, you know, come to the physicians at our anti-aging clinic, and we will. We will give you interventions to prevent aging. We don't have interventions that can prevent aging. We don't know how to do it. And those interventions that parade as anti-aging really fit, I'm sorry to say, you know, right back into our model. They don't do it. And some of them may really prove to be very, very dangerous. The one exception, at least in mice, and this has captured more attention than anyone might have anticipated, there is one way in mice of increasing longevity, and that is caloric restriction. But I don't mean watching your weight. We're talking about caloric restriction that would bring you to 60 to 70% below average weight. If you put mice on a near starvation diet, you actually increase longevity. Now, there are all kinds of, I'm smiling here, but, well, what if we really started to do caloric restriction as humans? Would that increase longevity? There are a few people out there who are, reducing their dietary intake, bringing their calories down to, 500 a day, et cetera. It hasn't, for all the obvious reasons, it's not exactly become a fad. But absent caloric restriction in mice, we don't know how to do it. And yet, if you just, casually read and hear the stories, you'd think we were on the brink of some kind of extraordinary breakthrough. We're not. And, no one should walk into an anti-aging clinic and think that they're actually going to get something effective.
We have a couple of listeners waiting to talk with us. Let's go to our first caller this afternoon on line four, a listener on a cell phone. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead.
Hi, I heard you talk about gastric bypass and the dangerous points of that long-term and short-term. Could you kind of talk a little bit more about that? We don't hear about that at all.
Well, there aren't a lot of studies out there yet, but I think in the past 10 days there was one story that was worrying about the consequences of that intervention. I'm not carrying the exact details in my head, but it's again just one of those, the procedure is recent. There's not a long-term track record with it. And no sooner does the procedure begin to involve more people over longer periods of time than one begins to find adverse effects of the procedure.
So with that procedure as well as others, do you eventually think that the liability considerations are going to put some controls in place?
Well, yes, but, I wish it wouldn't, liability and, malpractice, et cetera, those take so long and they're so after the fact. I guess what Sheila and I have been trying to urge is, caution before jumping in rather than suits later.
Okay, thank you very much.
Let's go back to something that I mentioned in my introduction. In the book, you say, quote, "The drive to enhancement is so deeply entrenched in our science and culture that neither religious nor social objections will be able to withstand, divert, or regulate it." That unstoppable drive, can it be slowed? Should it be slowed?
It's a great question, and it's one of the issues we spend a lot of time on. Many bioethicists, including the person who chairs the President Bush's Ethics Committee, Leon Cass, keep elevating the concept of, quote, the natural into this discussion, arguing that many of these interventions are unnatural and therefore ought not to be developed or really accepted. They would argue that someone living to 140 years of age is unnatural, that we ought to accept what we've been given, including, mortality, without tampering with nature and doing these so-called unnatural things. Cass, in an earlier period, was very, very opposed to in vitro fertilization. Unnatural, he claimed, generating babies, next generation, through those sorts of means. But the problem is that natural is such a slippery and elusive concept that it's very, very difficult to be able to use it to set guidelines and establish, you know, what is or is not permissible. I will say that of all the concepts that seem to make no sense whatsoever to scientists is the idea that one should respect the natural. Scientists want to play. Scientists want to go beyond nature. Sheila alluded to this at the very beginning of the program. You don't want to take what's given as given. You want to understand it, and you want to improve on it. It's a very fundamental scientific principle that I think, you know, I mean, many of us understand, empathize with, but keep wondering, should we set any limits? And if we were going to set limits, by what principles would we set limits? It's interesting in this respect because the great, you know, the great name, you know, familiar to all your listeners, of course, is Charles Darwin. Darwin argues that, you know, change comes by this evolutionary process, which is essentially random. Animals have characteristics. The environment will support some, not support others. We get the animals who are most fit to the environment dominating, and it's a very chance occurrence. As scientists in the late 19th century and then well into the 20th century read Darwin, what they took away from this message was that nature is full of chance. What survives is chance. And therefore, why do we necessarily have to respect chance? Let our will intervene. Let's see what we can do and not leave it to the chance of nature, but leave it to our own designs. So I think of all the things that science has no patience with, it's these concepts of the natural, these concepts that what is what should be. To scientists, what is, and let's see if we can improve on it. You know, a powerful impulse, God knows it's done us a lot of good, but it takes us into areas where, you know, you at least want to start raising your eyebrows and asking questions. The trouble is that the answers are not going to be found in simply saying, well, that's new, that's different, and therefore we shouldn't go there.
Hmm. When did we first begin re-engineering nature?
Sheila, do you want to take that one on?
Take it a bit, because I've been thinking more, but and we can come back to this. Mm-hmm. I think the other thing that is very important to us, which comes out of this, and what I wanted to talk about a bit, was that as we were doing this book, we really felt very strongly that one of the critiques of pursuit of perfection, as we describe it, has always been that people think it's frivolous. What's important to one person is seen as frivolous to another. And we don't think that this notion that people want to improve themselves, want to improve their appearance, their memory, so on, is frivolous at all. And we think it is really something that should be taken seriously. And that's why we're really so concerned about the risks and what's going on. We don't think it's going to be stopped. We think it's very much a part of the culture. And we think it's something that we know people take seriously, and it's not frivolous for them. And I think that the society, in turn, should take it seriously and begin to help people think about what the risks are, begin to think about oversight, and begin to think about how one's going to monitor you know, what people are taking, what's going on, so that it can be better balanced.
Yeah. Well, our current methods of oversight, adequate, inadequate, will they be adequate in the future? What would be adequate?
Well, the easiest part of your question is, are they adequate now? And the answer is
no.
I think unambiguously no.
Yeah.
They are not adequate. Organized medicine. I mean, I mentioned earlier these anti-aging clinics. I have yet to see, I mean, there are, you know, you will find, for example, at the NIH, there's an Institute on Aging, and the Institute on Aging will say, we don't know how to do anti-aging. I mean, there's no issue. But nobody says, hey, wait a minute, that anti-aging clinic in your neighborhood, you know, maybe something ought to be done, because, in fact, that banner is really not the kind of banner that has any scientific support. organized medicine hasn't done that. To the contrary, there's an anti-aging society that makes claims. The claims are not substantiated. The claims are not verifiable. And yet it continues. Obviously, we have some efforts to regulate what can be said about drugs. The FDA, Food and Drug Administration, does look at advertisements. But then drugs that are available to treat a disease, as the FDA has allowed, will often be used off-label in order to see whether or not they have enhancement kinds of potential. So that you go... at the regulatory level and at the level of organized medicine, the oversight is weak and leaves a lot to be desired. In this society, can we expect more? I'm not certain. I don't think the regulatory apparatus will be adequate to the problem. We close the book with... urging consumers to ultimately really take control and make their own decisions. If you're going to go into a doctor's office and tell the doctor that you're profoundly unhappy about this or that, I'm not talking about psychiatric illness. I'm talking about, look, I'm unhappy with, you know, the pace of my miles, I'm unhappy with my endurance, I'm unhappy with the signs of aging. Physicians really do like to make their patients happy, and, you know, press enough and you might get something. But before you do that, I mean, in the end, I mean, each one of us has got to ask, is my unhappiness such that I really want to run risks? Do I really want to go past what we know? Do I want to be the first in line, or do I want to wait and see what comes down as we have, you know, 10, 12 years of experience with a particular intervention? If you're impatient and you find that length of time too great, you may well plunge in, but you do it at your risk. On the other hand, patients, let's wait and see how the findings come. Do they hold? Are there consequences? But then you've got to be prepared to say, I'm not going to be the first in line. This is a country where a lot of people like to be the first in line, but it may not be in their long-term interest to stand first.
Yeah. Before we have to wrap up here this afternoon, I want to ask you about, this is a pretty big question, the social dimensions of medical enhancements. What are the risks to us collectively?
Sheila?
Well, I don't know. I mean, we're not really talking about genetic engineering, and we're not talking about the next generation. So, I mean, I think it's still at the level of the individual. If we were to go further, then I think we could be talking social in a very different way. But I think the whole thing is the question of the way we're seeing ourselves, the way we're trying to understand who we are and what we can become. And that, I mean, says a lot about us socially. And it's very interesting to talk about. Do you want to say anything more about it, David?
Well, I mean, we're not, you know, could we as a society tolerate 140 years coming to each of us? I mean, you know, what would that mean? Could we as a society, deal with, on a less profound level, imagine us as a society in which we only needed 2 hours sleep. The social readjustments would be really quite extraordinary. You would certainly want to, sell your stock in hotels and perhaps increase your stock holdings in movies or in athletic, this or that. The larger social issues, Sheila's saying, look, it's a little daunting because we can't yet know where the technologies would take us. The one change which has grabbed the most attention would be, what would happen if we lived 140 years? What would that do to the command of resources? As people who are part of an academic enterprise where there's tenure, would there ever be jobs for the young? Or in corporations, would there ever be jobs for the young? Could we handle any of this? in a marital state, would anybody be prepared to say, you know, till death do us part, if you were looking at 120 years of married life? It would be interesting. We're not there yet, so it's a little unclear as to how we would cope. Longevity has increased from 50 to 70 to 80 years. Those changes demanded upon us have been dealt with relatively well. If we doubled the lifespan, could we handle it as well? Not a question we have to resolve immediately. It would be interesting. But the only thing we can say, there are a lot of people working on it right now, but it's irresistible to try to do this, to understand cellular life, cellular death. Science is going to try to do it, and if that, you know, if an intervention came that made it look good, there'll be companies out there, and there'll be people ready to be first online. Goes without saying. Not at all clear that those who go first online are going to be the winners.
That's where we have to leave it. We've used up all the time. Sheila and David Rothman, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you for having us.
It's been a pleasure.
Sheila and David are the authors of The Pursuit of Perfection, The Promise and Perils of Medical Enhancement. The book is published by Pantheon Books. You've been listening to an interview from the AM 580 archives. You'll find interviews from the Afternoon Magazine and Focus 580 on our website. Visit WILL.UIUC.EDU.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety is proud to underwrite agricultural programming on WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
From the Chicago Board of Trade this afternoon, I'm Todd Gleason with the settlement prices at the board and the Mercantile Exchange. Of course, I'm here in the studios at WILL and not in Chicago. Let's take a look at what happened at the board. In fact, today, futures in the bean pit, the nearby contract, were sharply lower, down 35.5 cents. Not a reflection of what happened on the week, as USDA released numbers on a Thursday, that would be yesterday, that showed the crop not quite as large as most traders thought they would be. Actually, on the week, soybeans finished from the Friday to Friday closes 45.25 cents higher. The corn didn't do nearly as well. They were off 8 cents for the week. That's not the reflection either of what happened today at the board. Let's take a look at the daily numbers now from the Board of Trade. We'll begin where we always do, in the September wheat contract this afternoon. A high of 301, a low at 298, a settlement price at 299.5, and they were unchanged on the day. December futures, 315.5, the high, the low at 312.25, a settlement price there at 313.5, down a half cent. And the March wheat, 327.5, the high, the low at 324.75, settled at 325.25, a penny and a quarter lower. May futures in the wheat pit, 333, the high, the low at 330, and settlement there at 2 cents lower. And July at 339 on the high, the low at 335, settled at 335, down 3.25 for the day. From the corn pit, the nearby the September contract, 218.5, the high, the low at 215.5, settled 217.75. And they were down 0.25 cents on the day. December futures were off 3/4, 229.25 the high there. The low at 226.25, and a settlement price 0.75 cents lower in the December futures at 228.25 in the corn pit. March contract 237.75 high, low at 235.25, settlement price at 237, down 0.5. And the May corn off 0.75 cents, 243.75 the high, the low at 241.25, settled at 243.25. Once again, that May contract 0.75 cents lower for the day. July corn now 248.75 the high, the low at 246, settlement price at 248.5. They were off 0.5 in the September futures, 251 the high. The low in the September corn, 252 the high in the September corn. The settlement price was at 251, down 3/4, the low at 250.5. September oats, 127 the high, the low at 125, settlement price at 126, 1.5 lower. The December contract, 133.75 high, low at 130.5, settled 133, down 1.5 cents for the day. From the soy complex now, 712 was the high in the nearby August contract. It went off the board today, by the way. 645 was the low, expired at 652, 35.5 cents lower. Your lead option, 590 settlement price, or rather 590 the high in the Septembers, which are now the lead option. For the high, the low at 581, a settlement price at 586.25, down 3.75 cents on the day for that September bean contract. November beans, 584.5, the high. Low at 575, settlement price at 580 and three quarters. They were 4.5 cents lower. And the January futures, 589, the high, the low at 580, settled 586, down 4.75. March contract from the bean pit, 596, the high, the low at 587.5, settlement price there at 592.5. They were 4.5 cents lower for the day. And the May futures, 601, the high, the low at 593.5, a settlement price at 597.25. Down 5.5 cents on the day. From the bean meal pit, the nearby contract trading the August at 207 on the high, the low at 191, a settlement price there at 198.50. They were off 350 for the August bean meal. And the September futures were off 180 at 187.90 at the end of the day, with a high of 192.50 and a low at 184.70. August bean oil, 24 was the high, the low at $23.30, settled 23.57, down 43. And the September's 23.15, the high, the low at 22.78, settled 23.06, and they finished the day 11 cents lower. Now, from the Mercantile Exchange, let's take a look at the numbers there for the day. Futures in the feeder cattle pit and the live cattle pit were mostly higher for the day. The August contract, 116.60 in the feeders for the high, the low at 115.60, settled 116.55. They were up 177.5. And the September futures, a 115.40 high, low at 113.60. Settlement price there at 115.12.5. Up 235 for the day. October feeder cattle, 115.20, the high, the low at 113.50. Settlement price at 114.55, and they were up $2.07 on the afternoon. August live cattle now, 87.65, the high, the low at 86.25, settled 87.55. They were 245 higher, and the October live cattle, $90.05, the high, the low at 88.75, settled 89.80, 100 weight, and they were up 227.5 for the day. From the lean hog pit, 78.35 was the high trade in the August, the low at 78.10, settled 78.20, and they were 15 higher on the day. The October futures, 68.60, the high, the low at 67.20, settled 68.32.5, up 152.5. December futures for the hog, 64.50, the high, the low at 63.40, a settlement price at 64.42.5, up 112.5, and the February contract, 63.50, the high, the low at $62 even. Settlement price there at 63.40, up 145 for the day. The bellies finished the day 50 cents lower at 93.60.
Enter the WILL sweepstakes today and win a fabulous prize for your home. A widescreen, high-definition TV from Champion Audio, a Dell computer, a lounge chair and ottoman from Carter's Furniture, or a $1,000 gift certificate from Corley Photography. And if your entry is postmarked by August 19th, you'll be eligible to win the Early Bird Prize, $500 worth of colorful plants and shrubs for your garden from Country Arbors. To request an entry form, call 217-333-0850. Don't wait. Send your entry in today.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Lloyd Loring from South Bend, Indiana writes, Dear Dr. Science, a scientist, eh? As such, I assume you make no statements that are not based on provable fact, and yet you permit the announcer to continue making his audacious claim that, quote, he knows more than you do, unquote, during each broadcast. Where is your scientific proof of this assertion? Perhaps you make the assumption that if a person is listening, you must be smarter than they, since they are stupid enough to listen to you.
Look who woke up on...